Today is Monday, December 14th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the Electoral College votes today to confirm Joe Biden's presidential election victory.
Electors in state capitals on Monday will cast their ballots in favor of Biden's 306 to 232 electoral vote win.
Also ahead, we hear from the Polisario Front about U.S. recognition of Morocco's claim to Western Sahara.
Mr. Trump is trying to substitute the will of the Sahrawi people and impose his own will.
Plus, what's next for Brexit? These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S., where COVID-19 cases and deaths continue to surge. The U.S. averaged nearly 214,000 new cases each day over the last week, with new deaths above 2,400 a day. It's part of the largest outbreak on Earth, but there is a glimmer of hope on the horizon. The U.S. has approved emergency use of the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine, paving the way for Americans to start getting vaccinated within days. But public skepticism about the safety of the vaccine remains, with polls showing many adults saying they won't get the shot or are unsure about getting it. VOA's senior White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara has the latest.
This hospital in Chicago is preparing to deliver COVID-19 vaccines made by Pfizer-BioNTech that were approved for emergency use by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration Friday night. Logistical challenges include keeping the vaccine at the extremely cold temperature of minus 70 degrees Celsius using specially designed temperature-controlled thermal shippers and freezers. Dr. Erin Shaughnessy is the director of pharmacy of Rush University Medical Center.
That ultra-low freezer, we can only open for 2 minutes at a time, otherwise it'll go out of range, so we have to be very precise in our movements. And once we take the drug out, we have to move it to the refrigerator within a 10-minute time frame so it doesn't fall into the ultra-quick defrost. If it defrosts too quickly, we only get 2 hours stability. If we can defrost it slowly, we get 5 days of stability.
Immediately following the vaccine's approval, President Donald Trump released a video on Twitter hailing the news as a medical miracle. He said the first immunizations would take place in less than 24 hours.
We want our senior citizens, healthcare workers, and first responders to be first in line. This will quickly and dramatically reduce deaths and hospitalizations.
Trump's announcement followed media reports of his chief of staff threatening to fire the head of the Food and Drug Administration, Stephen Hahn, if he did not grant emergency use approval by Friday.
All of his room staff will have COVID.
Vaccine approval came as COVID-19 cases soared, with almost 300,000 confirmed deaths. Yet some Americans are skeptical about vaccine safety.
I definitely feel like it's too fast. We don't know the side effects. It hasn't been tested long enough.
We want to make sure that this works for real, you know, because you don't want to take something that is going to make everything worse for you.
A recent survey by the Associated Press shows about half of U.S. adults say they won't get the vaccine or are unsure if they will.
Good afternoon, everyone.
President-elect Joe Biden, who spoke Friday morning after the vaccine was recommended but not yet approved, sought to allay public skepticism of political influence in its approval.
You should have confidence in this. There is no political influence. These are first-rate scientists taking their time looking at all of the elements that need to be looked at. Scientific integrity led us to this point.
Despite the vaccine's approval, there is still much planning and details to be finalized at the state and local level in terms of when and where Americans can get the vaccine. Dr. Anand Parekh is the Bipartisan Policy Center's chief medical advisor.
In the case of healthcare workers, you can find them in healthcare settings. So, and in the case of long-term care residents, certainly they're in long-term care facilities. So it may not mean as much for the first two priority groups. But once you start to talk about essential workers, the elderly, those distribution points and pointing to where people need to go and at what time will be absolutely critical.
The U.S. is now the sixth country to approve this two-dose regimen, including Britain, Bahrain, Canada, Saudi Arabia, and Mexico. Patsy Whitaker-Swara, VOA News.
Also in the U.S., the Electoral College votes today to formally select Democrat Joe Biden as the country's 46th president. But current President Donald Trump continues to claim he won re-election last month. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports from Wilmington, Delaware.
U.S. President Donald Trump on Twitter and in a TV interview aired Sunday claims the election process is not over and he is being defrauded of another four-year term. State election officials have decided otherwise, and electors in state capitals on Monday will cast their ballots in favor of Biden's 306 to 232 electoral vote win. The president-elect, in a Monday evening address from his home state of Delaware, will speak on the Electoral College vote certification and the strength and resilience of our democracy, according to a statement from his transition team. Steve Herman, VOA News, Wilmington, Delaware.
Today's Electoral College vote comes after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a lawsuit Friday backed by President Donald Trump to overturn Joe Biden's election victory. The rejection ended an attempt to get the case before the nation's highest court after several state and federal judges had already rejected it. In a brief order, the court said Texas does not have the legal right to sue Michigan, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin because it, quote, has not demonstrated a judicially cognizable interest in the manner in which another state conducts its elections, end quote. For more International Editions, Steve Miller spoke to Joel Richard Paul, a constitutional law professor at the University of California Hastings College of Law.
So the Supreme Court's jurisdiction is primarily as an appellate level court. It only hears appeals, except in cases that are brought by one state against another state. So this was a case brought by Texas, and the state of Texas was making the argument here that they were somehow injured by the way in which the other states conducted their election. And what the Supreme Court decided in this case is that that argument on its face is just fallacious, that there is no actual cognizable injury suffered by the state of Texas. So the court, in denying standing, was basically saying there's no case here. There's no injury suffered by Texas. They have no right to come into court.
Thank you. And we're talking about states and standing. Now, both President Trump and his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, have said that the fight is not over, and possibly they would look at filing a new lawsuit in the District of Columbia where the president resides to give him standing. But so many of the president's legal challenges have been rejected by courts. So what do you make out of this legal strategy?
Well, it doesn't make any sense. The cases have now been rejected by nearly 60 courts, including about 58 judges who are Republican appointees. The theory of the case is essentially a denial of objective truth that Biden won the election and a denial of the principle of democracy under the law. The courts have repeatedly found that there was no evidence of widespread fraud, and the Department of Justice found the same thing.
That was Joel Richard Paul, a constitutional law professor at the University of California, Hastings, speaking to International Editions' Steve Miller. Despite the election loss, some of Trump's most ardent supporters are not backing down. Over the weekend, thousands of Trump supporters marched in Washington for the president to remain in office despite losing the election. The march included members of a far-right group known as the Proud Boys, some of whose members have been linked to white supremacy. The protest devolved into violence Saturday evening amid clashes between Trump supporters who were opposed by left-wing anti-fascist counter-protesters. Multiple people were stabbed and around two dozen arrested in D.C., and two historic black churches were attacked by right-wing marchers. They tore Black Lives Matter signs from the churches. One sign was lit on fire. In a statement posted on Twitter, Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser condemned what she called, quote, forces of hate, end quote, that carried out the church attacks and asked the public for information on those responsible. Also, one person was shot during political clashes in the city of Olympia in the Pacific Northwest state of Washington. As President-elect Joe Biden continues to make key appointments to his cabinet, many are watching to see if he fulfills his pledge to have the most diverse cabinet in the history of the U.S. For more, my colleague Chinedu Ofor spoke with VOA's national affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins in Washington.
From talking to civil rights leaders and others in the Black community, they have indicated that they think it's a good start to helping to repair U.S. race relations, because they have seen the beginnings of an administration which President-elect Joe Biden said wanted to be reflective of the vast ethnicity we have in the United States. And these initial picks, there have been quite a few African Americans, Latinos, and Asian Americans selected for these jobs, as well as Indian Americans. So they're seeing a administration that looks different from the current administration. I think that what you see is race relations are not very good in the United States right now. A Gallup public opinion poll from September showed that 55% of Americans felt that race relations between whites and Black Americans are very bad or somewhat bad, and that fewer than half of Americans, 44%, race relations in the U.S. as good. But right now, the initial indications are good. I think a lot of Black and brown people see people who were in the Barack Obama administration, and they reflect positively on that administration and his presidency.
President-elect Biden pledged that his would probably be the most diverse in the history of the United States. Do you think he's on his way to fulfilling that promise?
Well, it looks to be that way. Right now, by my count, out of the 18 picks he has so far made, 8 of those picks are minorities. And I think you have to look further than just the cabinet picks. You have to look at the White House staff, which has more diversity. And I think you have to look at some of the other pieces of the administration, for instance, like the COVID-19 task force. We know minorities in the United States are disproportionately impacted adversely by the coronavirus.
Do you think this will satisfy the diverse elements within the Democratic Party?
Well, the full impact remains to be seen. I think initially progressives or more liberal members of the Democratic Party have remained a little bit silent, waiting for all of the choices to fill in. But they have indicated that not only do they want progressives, but they want progressives in some of the bigger leadership positions of the administration.
That was VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins speaking with my colleague Chinedu Ofor. This is VOA. Tens of thousands of protesting Indian farmers have called for a second national strike in a week, demanding the quashing of 3 new agricultural reform laws. The laws deregulate crop prices, which the farmers say will drive down prices and devastate their earnings. The farmers are camping along at least 5 major highways on the outskirts of New Delhi and have said they won't leave until the government rolls back what they call the Black Laws. They have blockaded highways leading to the capital for 3 weeks. Several rounds of talks with the government have failed to produce any breakthroughs. Heavy contingents of police in riot gear are patrolling the areas. The government says the laws will modernize India's agricultural sector. The government of Eswatini has confirmed the death of Prime Minister Ambrose Dlamini. The 52-year-old Dlamini had been prime minister since 2018. He announced in November that he had tested positive for COVID-19 and was being treated at a hospital in neighboring South Africa. The government said he died Sunday afternoon. The country has recorded almost 7,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases and about 127 deaths. And in Thailand, a leading protester says demonstrators will take a break from their regular marches and return stronger next year, Reuters reports. The students-led protests have gone on for months, demanding reforms to curb the monarchy's powers and demanding the prime minister step down. Rights lawyer Arnon Nampa said this year's protests have been, quote, just an overture, end quote, and will resume after the New Year holiday. Nampa spoke to journalists at a police station where he reported to face charges related to his activism. A government spokesman told Reuters that protesters may gather again next year, but only if they are peaceful. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. There has been widespread global backlash in recent days over U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Morocco's claim of sovereignty over the disputed Western Sahara region, including from senior members of Trump's Republican Party. The Polisario Front, which is the political and military leadership of the self-declared Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic in Western Sahara, says it rejects Trump's move, standing by its long-standing accusation that Morocco illegally occupies the lands of the Sahrawi people. Morocco, which has held Western Sahara since Spain left in 1975, says it regards the vast desert region as an integral part of its own territory. The UN has said the issue should be solved by a referendum of the people of Western Sahara. Now there are fears that a flare-up of violence in the region last month between Morocco forces and the Polisario Front could escalate. For more, I reached out to Mouloud Saïd, who is the Polisario Front's representative to Washington, D.C., and is currently in Spain. Mouloud, thank you for joining us. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
So this recognition of Morocco's claim to sovereignty comes as Morocco has normalized ties with Israel. Where do things stand from the perspective of the Polisario Front?
First of all, this statement that Mr. Trump made, he made a statement without mentioning any legal base for it, any legal argument. He said that Morocco was the first country, one of the first countries to recognize the United States. Therefore, I'm giving him Western Sahara. I mean, as if Western Sahara is a piece of real estate sitting there with no owners, or if we are a commodity that can be part of an international transaction. So for us, this has no effect, and it does not change the nature of the conflict. As you know, the Sahrawi Republic, Western Sahara, the Sahrawi Republic, is a full-fledged member of the African Union as an independent country, and Morocco is occupying part of that country. So for us, this does not change anything. And it's very important to see the reaction of the internet, not just members of the United States Senate and Congress and different politicians and the press in the United States, but also the reaction internationally. I'm sure you saw the statement by the European Union, by the UK, by Sweden, by the African Union, by the United Nations. All of them, they said that this has no value, has no ground, and nobody is supporting this move because it's a violation, a flagrant violation of international law. This is taking us back to the law of the jungle. So this is, we believe that's not going to have any effect. It's not going to stop us from fighting with more determination until we put an end to the Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara.
You mentioned Trump's statement that Morocco recognized the United States in 1777. And when Trump announced this, he also said on Twitter, and I quote, "Morocco's serious, credible, and realistic autonomy proposal is the only basis for a just and lasting solution for enduring peace and prosperity," end quote. What is your response to that?
That should be the response of the Sahrawi people, whether it's that the autonomy is the best plan. That should be something acceptable by the Sahrawi people, but it cannot be the substitute of the will of the Sahrawi people. This is the thing that Mr. Trump is trying to substitute the will of the Sahrawi people and impose his own will on the Sahrawis, violating its right to self-determination. So we don't believe that we're in the times of emperors dictating, but we have a law, we have the United Nations, we have the Security Council, and unfortunately, the United States, which is a member of the Security Council, now is just disqualifying itself from playing a role in looking for the real solution to the conflict based on the respect of the right of the people to self-determination. But for him to say that this is the only solution, so he's substituting himself to the will of the Sahrawi people.
Now, there are some concerns that this could lead to an escalation in the disputes. And of course, in November, there were clashes between the two sides, as well as a border incident in October. What is the Polisario Front's stance on whether there might be a return to serious armed conflict in Western Sahara?
It's not a matter that there will be. It's already, since November the 13th, and we made it in a public statement on November 14th, that we disassociate ourselves from the ceasefire that was holding since 1991. The reason is that Morocco, on November 13th, they crossed the buffer zone and in violation of the ceasefire. So right now, there are attacks that we're attacking the Moroccan position.
Now, there's a new presidential administration coming in. President-elect Joe Biden will become president next month. How do you think the Joe Biden administration might approach this?
I can only speak out of my observation of all the years that I have been following President-elect Biden. I know that he was chairman for many, many years, chairman of the International Relations Committee in the Senate. And he's a man who is very much for the multilateral approach to any issue, international issues. And I'm sure he's not going to be following the unilateral approach that Trump has been taking, in particular in the question of Western Sahara. So the only thing I can say that we are very hopeful that the new administration will respect the international law, the international regulations, and the right of self-determination for the Sahrawi people. That's our hope.
That was Mahloud Saeed, the Polisario Front's representative to Washington, D.C., speaking to me from Spain. Mahloud, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
VOA could not independently verify the claim of continued attacks on Moroccan positions. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said there is a, quote, strong possibility, end quote, that a new Brexit deal before January 1st will fail, despite a last-minute effort to secure an agreement with the European Union Commission. VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with journalist Henry Ridgewell in London on the areas of disagreement.
There are three outstanding issues. They are access to British fishing waters for European boats after the 31st of December. It's what we call level playing field regulations, which is whether Britain will be allowed to support its own industries, which the EU would see as unfair after Brexit, and how that deal would be governed after the 31st of December. Who would be the referee, essentially, if there was a disagreement over trade between the two sides?
The UK signed a couple of trade deals with Canada and some other countries in the East. Is this an indication from the government that it's just a matter of time before it just exits the EU without a deal?
These trade deals that Britain has signed with other countries are important because essentially they're rolling over the trade arrangements that Britain has as a member of the European Union. So up until now, up until the December the 31st, the end of the transition period, Britain is, to all intents and purposes, still a member of the European Union. And therefore, it is trading with Singapore, with Canada, with South Korea, whoever it may be, under European Union terms. Of course, all that comes to an end on January the 1st, 2021, in just under 3 weeks' time.
There are reports that the government is testing what it calls a contraflow system. What is that?
That's right. That's on the key arterial freeways that join the port of Dover. So you imagine the geography of the United Kingdom of Britain, an island on the edge of the European mainland. Almost all of our maritime trade is funneled through a few ports, particularly Dover-Calais, for many trucks who use the ferries and the Channel Tunnel to import and export goods from the European mainland. That's all very well when we're a member of the European Union, when there are no border checks between Dover and Calais on the French side. But when you add in the customs checks that will be done on January the 1st and going forward, you imagine that every single truck is going to have to be checked for its correct paperwork. The goods on board are going to have to be checked. And even if each single truck takes an extra 5 minutes only to be checked, you times that by the tens of thousands of trucks that are using those crossings, those few crossings over the English Channel every day, and it soon adds up to huge delays on those key arterial road networks that join the British cities to those ports. And so there is a big fear in Britain that there will be huge traffic jams, huge tailbacks on those freeways leading to Dover, And so what the government has done is come up with these new systems of traffic management, whereby essentially the main motorway, the main freeway that heads to Dover, the M20, will be used as a truck park.
That was journalist Henry Ridgewell in London speaking to VOA's Chinedu Ofor here in Washington. And that's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.